Christians, many of them all over the world, depending on their tradition, are observing Lent right now. It's a period when people typically fast from something, give something up, in an effort to identify with the sufferings of Christ and just prepare our hearts and minds for Easter. Brandy texted me from work. She's given up sugar. She texted me from work the other day and said, "There's donuts in the office today." Ah, and I said, "Well, now you know how Jesus felt." This was clearly the same thing. We're sneaking up on Easter, man. It's just a few weeks away. And we as a church, this is going to be our third Easter. So maybe you've been coming here for just a very short period of time and you didn't know you were part of like a church planting team. Welcome to the team. We're going to step out this year. We're going to do something we haven't done before. You may have noticed in the first couple of years that Christmas and Easter, usually it's very full here. And so we're gonna step out and have two services this year in an effort to allow God or work with God, work with the Spirit, and make a way for more people to be exposed to the gospel. And you might remember if you were here when Pastor Joe Whitwer was with us last summer, he identified one critical turning point for churches that grow to be more effective, and that is it becomes we. It becomes a we endeavor. And so we're gonna have two services on Easter, and if it's just Pastor Rick and I at 9 o'clock, it's gonna be awkward. So really we're counting on it being a team effort. And some people will be maybe helping out, maybe in an area of doing music or tech or helping with kids. What an opportunity to come to one service and then serve in the other or vice versa. But really what we're hoping to do as a team is just go out and gather up the people we know and love and bring them to have an opportunity for God to work in their lives. And we're not going to deviate very far from what we normally do. We just want to make an opportunity for God to work in people's lives. So go team. We're going to do that together. This week, this morning, we are in chapter 9 of the story. We've been working through it, just trying to get a good high-level picture of the entire biblical narrative from beginning to end. We're in chapter 9 of 31. I think there's a couple of them left on the table back there. If you don't have one and you want one, feel free to grab it. If you don't have that, it's very easy to follow because today's story is basically the entire book of Ruth. And every man in America will say, "Thank God it's a really short book." It's only a couple pages, just a few pages in the Bible, but that's where we'll be at. So let me catch you up. Chapter 1. In the beginning, God made everything, and he made it very good. There was no sin, there was no death, there was no disease, there was no strife. It was good. It was all very good. But if you've read the story, you know it took about 3 pages into the entire biblical narrative for sin to enter the scene. And it wasn't gruesome. It wasn't a horrible situation. It wasn't terrifying. God just simply said to the man and the woman, "Do whatever you want, just don't eat the fruit off that tree." And they said, "Yeah, I think I will eat the fruit off that tree." And through one small act of rebellion, sin entered the world, and we are reaping the benefits to this very day. But God had a plan to bring all things back to very good, and he started with a guy named Abraham. You might remember he led Abraham and his family to a land called Canaan, and he said, "Look around, this is the land I'm going to give to you and your descendants forever." And his family stayed there for about 200 years. Famine drove them out of the land, and they went to Egypt, probably just to buy some food, and ended up staying for over 400 years. And the family, of course, multiplied, became basically a nation in Egypt. And then maybe you remember a guy named Moses came along and led them out of Egypt. Joshua took over from Moses and led them back in to reclaim the promised land 500 years after they had left. And that's where we're at in the story. Now Joshua has died. And we've entered a period that's referred to as the period of the judges. Pastor Rick introduced us to that last week. And it's interesting because the judges, if I was to try and just give you a snapshot description of the judges, I would describe them as the national dad. They're just the head of the household in every possible way. And Joshua and Moses had kind of filled that role similarly before them. But the difference is they're not nomadic. They're not a nomadic people. They're not a warring people. They're not enslaved in Egypt anymore. They're in the promised land, and they've kind of just settled in to a way of life. They've arrived there, and it requires a different type of leader. And so God institutes this, the judges. That's his current system. And so where we're at chronologically in the landscape, Joshua was their leader. He led them into the promised land. His entire generation served God, followed God faithfully, and they were prosperous because of it. But here's where they're at right now. Judges 2:10 says, when all Joshua's generation had been gathered to their fathers, that's the biblical family-friendly way of saying they were all dead, another generation arose who knew neither the Lord nor the work he had done for Israel. So guess what happened? One generation rose. They were faithful. They loved God. They followed him. The next generation completely forgot. Said, yeah, that was nice. We're going to go do it our way. It's just this carousel of stupidity that the entire nation of Israel is on. The cycle is just like on repeat for thousands of years over and over. And so that's where we're at. Things aren't going great in the promised land. And we're going to be introduced to a guy named Elimelech. Not surprisingly, that name didn't stick. But he has a pretty interesting story. Here's why this overall narrative is important, though. Because if we don't understand the big picture story of the Bible, we could pick up this particular story, and we could read about Elimelech, and we could attempt to formulate judgments on what this is really about. The problem is, Elimelech's story has a framework. It's a tiny little piece in the big story, in the big narrative. And so if we don't understand the big narrative, what's the story of the Bible? What's God doing? Then we're left to just grab the pieces independently of themselves, and sometimes we get it right and sometimes we don't. So the big story really, really matters. It's important for us to take a look at the whole picture. So let's do that. I'm going to bare my soul to you right now. Don't judge me. When I was a kid, I used to get birthday cards, and they would usually have something in them. Cash, you know, that's always like the best. That's ideal. I was a kid in the 80s and 90s, so sometimes people sent checks. They didn't have gift cards. They were called gift certificates back then. Don't ever ask for a gift certificate at the store because the person serving you will immediately add 20 years to your actual age if you do. Movie tickets, that kind of thing. Stuff in the card, right? Like you remember that. Probably that was your experience. Now that I'm in my 30s, I usually just get the card. But that's okay. Because now I appreciate the sentiment more than I appreciate the movie tickets. But there was this awkward transitional phase where I was used to getting stuff in the card, but now I'm becoming an adult, and so people are starting to send the card without the stuff in it, maybe thinking that I'll appreciate the sentiment, but they were tragically wrong during that awkward phase. So I'd open the card, and if there was nothing in it, I would feel disappointment. I'd be really bummed out, really let down by it. But I'd also feel really bad about the fact that I felt bummed out about not getting something. Does anybody else know what I'm talking about? Okay, good. So I'm not the biggest jerk in the world. I'm one of the biggest jerks in the world. So, and we've all congregated together here in this room. Isn't that amazing? Take that sentiment, that feeling of letdown, and then translate it to something that actually matters. Maybe you're a person who you had a job that you thought you'd work at for 30 years, and 13 years in, you were downsized out of the company. Or maybe you got married thinking your marriage would be a seamless partnership, but you ended up marrying a human instead. Or maybe you raised kids to make great choices, but one of them didn't seem to get the message. A lot of possible circumstances. Maybe you went to college or you're going to college to be a marketing executive, but you do a job that pays far less and is far less glamorous than what you had in mind. Life's full of disappointments like that. Every person can understand that. We've all been let down. This story, the story of Ruth, Naomi, Boaz, these characters, it's kind of anecdotal. It's just kind of an aside to the big story of the Bible. But it's a small story that gives us a snapshot of the big story. There's no way that for them, at the time it was happening, they could have understood all of the implications that we can see now. But what this story does do for them is it speaks to one of the basic realities of human existence, disappointment. Whether you're a Christian or you're not a Christian, disappointment is real. Disappointment is a fact of life, being let down, being discouraged. And it begs a really obvious question for a lot of us. If God has the power to so easily stop disappointment, why doesn't he do it? Why does he allow that to happen in our lives? Maybe you've reached the point where you're just that mature in your faith that you're okay. You've come to grips with the disappointment. Praise God if that's where you are. But I think most humans would love to know, why does this have to happen? Why are we so often let down in life? And I love this story of Ruth because it's a really short story that takes the burden off of us to come up with the answer. Because the story speaks for itself. If we just examine the story, consider the implications, consider the people, consider the actions of God, it speaks for itself. It demonstrates God's response to our questions about the disappointment in life. So I think it's a pretty significant story for us. In the storybook, they called chapter 9 The Faith of the Foreign Woman. I think that's a terrible title because I think that's actually a small part of the story. Nonetheless, I'm looking forward to it. It's the entire book of Ruth, and it's really important to our understanding about God. So important that the Jews, the Israelites, to this very day, as part of their celebration of Passover, they read the story of Ruth in its entirety. That's a formalized part of their celebration. So to them, apparently this is a really critical piece of their understanding of God. It's a really clear window, a look into God's heart for the circumstances of your life. So if you're not familiar with it, I hope you'll try to get your head around it. Read it this week. It really is a significant story. So at the start of chapter 9, we meet this guy, Elimelech. Elimelech is a Jewish guy living in the promised land, just living the dream, doing life. Apparently, he's a landowner. He's got a wife. He's got two sons. He's doing well. Things are going okay. But during his lifetime, Israel falls on hard times. There's a famine. Probably means there was a drought. And in an agrarian society, if there's a drought, there's no food and there's no jobs, obviously. So he decides that he's going to take action. Now, just try to envision yourself being a husband and father in a situation where you have no capacity to provide for your family. And just to help you get in that mindset, I pulled a movie clip from the Russell Crowe movie, Cinderella Man.
Can I help you?
Sorry, lady, you passed too.
No. No, you can't. You can't. There's kids.
If I don't, they let me go. They already let two guys go.
Please. It's what we got left that keeps us hanging on.
Lady, I got kids too.
674. How much to turn it back on?
4 months. 4412.
If I work 26 hours out of every 24, it still won't add up. Nothing left to sell. All the guys you could have married, huh?
Yeah. What happened to those guys? Since this afternoon, bless us, O Lord, and these thy gifts which we are about to receive from thy bounty.
Elimelech is all prayed out. Have you been prayed out? Have you been to that point where the frustration has reached a level where you're prayed out? You might still believe that God could do something, but apparently he's not going to. I'm done. Elimelech is emotionally done. And he has a situation to make in this situation. Is he going to stay here in the land that God brought them to, or is he going to pack up and head for greener pastures? He decides to leave. He chose the latter. And on the surface, it makes good sense because he's leaving a place where there's a famine and he's taking his family to a place where there's abundance. But his mistake is he doesn't consider the spiritual cost. He doesn't account for that. He doesn't count it very well. So this is what happens in Ruth 1:1. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah, that name might sound familiar, he's from Bethlehem of all places, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech, which, by the way, means my God and king. His wife's name was Naomi, which means pleasant. And the names of his sons were Mahlon and Chilion, which literally mean sick and dying. I kid you not. I can't believe those names aren't around anymore. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to Moab and lived there. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. They were married to Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other named Ruth. After they had lived there about 10 years, Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left with her two sons, without her two sons and her husband. When Naomi heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, she and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living and set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. Then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show you kindness as you have shown kindness to your dead husbands and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband." Then she kissed them goodbye, and they wept aloud and said to her, "We will go back with you to your people." But Naomi said, "No. Return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I am too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters, it is more bitter for me than for you because the Lord's hand has turned against me." At this, they wept aloud again. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. They went to the land so they wouldn't die. They went to Moab so they wouldn't die. But what happened? Calamity. Her husband and her sons died anyway. Surely that's not what she was anticipating when she left the land of a famine to go to the land of abundance. Surely she was anticipating prosperity. Surely Ruth is unbelievably let down, unbelievably disappointed and discouraged by this situation. So now she's going to attempt to go back to Bethlehem, hopefully find some relatives there who will take care of her, have pity on her in her old age. And she's sending her daughters-in-law back to their family. Orpah leaves. She probably didn't want to, it doesn't sound like, but she realized that's probably her best course of action. But Naomi had a different response. Ruth had a different response. "Look," said Naomi, "your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her." But Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to leave you or turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me." When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. Now, this passage is really famous. You hear it at weddings a lot. The context is obviously different, but the sentiment remains the same. If the context, we used it in context, the bride would literally turn to her mother-in-law and say, "Where you stay, I will stay." And I don't think that tradition is going to catch on. Nonetheless, the sentiment is essentially the same, and it's really powerful. I mean, this is an unbelievable statement of commitment on Ruth's part. "I will not leave you. I am with you to the very end. I will actually be buried in the same place that you're buried." It's an unbelievable statement of commitment. But she also says something else that's really significant. She's not Jewish. She's not an Israelite. She's a Moabite. Her family, the environment she grew up in, they worshipped idols in this case. But what she says in here is a statement of her faith in the Hebrew God. She believes that Naomi's God, Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews, is God. And she actually goes a step beyond calling God, God, to calling him Lord. She calls Naomi's God her Lord, which is a different sentiment, because Lord implies I'm subjecting myself to your authority. It's a really interesting change of heart. That's the difference between her and her sister-in-law who left. And in Ruth's mind, the best course of action for these two widows is to trust God. That's their best course of action in this situation. And it has pretty far-reaching implications. So they head off together to go back to Canaan, back to Bethlehem. And when they arrive there, of course, Naomi's from there, so people recognize her. They know her. They're excited to see her. But she's not nearly so excited. This is what Naomi said to them. "Don't call me Naomi," which you'll remember means pleasant. "Don't call me Naomi," she said to them. call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life bitter. Mara literally means bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me. Naomi has surrendered herself to bitterness. She is resigned to bitterness. Don't call me pleasant, call me bitter. Have you ever been bitter? Are you bitter? Is there a person or a situation or a group of people that if I named them right now, you'd have a negative emotional reaction? Probably yes, for all of us. Probably all of us have been hurt by someone or something or some circumstance. All of us have been let down by people. We all understand this idea of bitterness. Maybe you felt like it's God who's let you down. Maybe that's your feeling. Maybe you feel like I've been treated really unfairly in this situation. When we feel that way, we have to answer basically the same question that both Naomi and Ruth have to answer in their circumstance, and that is, what will this story be about? What will be the defining characteristic? Will my story be about the fall, or will it be about the comeback? What will define my story? Will it be a tragedy, or will it be a comeback story? That's a decision that we get to make. That's a choice that we have. For Ruth and Naomi, the story has been about loss. That's all there is in this story so far. And it's interesting because Ruth seems hopeful. Naomi seems resigned. Naomi has given into the fact that this is my lot in life. God has afflicted me, and she's become bitter. Here's the thing. Loss is an inevitable fact of life. If you haven't experienced it yet, just find someone in the room who's older than you and ask them, and they'll tell you, keep breathing, you will experience it. Loss is an inevitable fact of life. Pastor Rick and I have a really dear friend and mentor, Dr. Jerry Sitzer. Some of you know him, and you maybe know his story. Dr. Jerry experienced what I would say is a painful experience that is on plane with the worst circumstances that a human could ever experience, beyond my capacity to probably really appreciate. In one moment, one car accident, the car he was driving was hit by a drunk driver. He lost three generations of the women in his family, his mother, his wife, and his daughter. That's a tough night. I would say that's probably on plane with the worst experience a person could possibly have. And I tell you just a little tidbit of his story so that when I read his quote, you won't think it's just feel-good pastor speak. You'll know that it's coming from someone, from a voice of experience. This is what Dr. Jerry said in his book, A Grace Disguised. The experience of loss does not need to be the defining moment of our story. The story doesn't have to be about the loss. The story could be about our response to the loss. We like to think we control our own destiny, and to some degree we do, but we can't control all of the things that come at us in life. The only thing we can control is how we respond to those. Here's why the big story matters, because if you look at Naomi, all she can see is what's right in front of her. She's paralyzed by her immediate circumstance. That has her mindset, her emotions are gripped by the immediate circumstance. That's all she can see. And when she's focused on the immediate circumstance, what happens to her? She becomes bitter. That happens to us too. She's completely unaware of the fact that God is doing something in the grand scheme and that there's actually something on the other side of her immediate circumstance, but it's just a wall. She can't see past it, and it's made her bitter. By faith, determined to believe in the grand scheme. Determined to rise. Determined to believe that God is doing something bigger in your circumstance. This is what Naomi couldn't do, but what Ruth is attempting to do. So I want to read you a verse from Leviticus 19. And it's interesting. It was written a couple hundred years before. This is back when they were wandering in the desert and God gave them the law. He gave them essentially the rules that would govern their way of life. And this was one of his commands to the people. He said, when you reap the harvest of your land, do not reap to the very edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. Do not go over your vineyard a second time or pick up the grapes that have fallen. Leave them for the poor and the foreigner. I am the Lord your God. So he instructed them, listen, don't take all of the food. We need to take care of the people who have nowhere else to go. Leave some behind so that so that the poor and the foreigners can come and pick it up. Now watch what happens in Naomi and Ruth's situation. Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth, the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning. It's almost like God had a plan to take care of them. It's almost like he knew a couple hundred years before what was going to happen. It's almost like that. Almost. So watch what takes place next. It's so circumstantial. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, "Let me go to the fields and pick up the leftover grain behind anyone in whose eyes I find favor." Now bear in mind, even though God gave the command, not everyone was going to do it. So she's got to find someone who's going to show favor to her and to actually obey God. Naomi said to her, "Go ahead, my daughter." So she went out, entered a field, and began to glean behind the harvesters. As it turned out, she was working in a field belonging to Boaz, who was from the clan of Elimelech. As it turned out. It's almost like God knew it was going to happen. It's almost like he was planning ahead. I'm just saying. What could God possibly be trying to teach us through this story? He's planning ahead. He is fully aware of the challenges that are going to come up against you and I, but he's planning ahead. He's planning beyond just our immediate circumstance. I love the fact that God's plan isn't paralyzed by my crisis of immediacy. When I go, "Oh shoot, I don't have enough money in the bank to pay this bill," God doesn't put like the entire cosmos on pause until I figure out how to pay the bill. He has a plan for what's going to happen. He knows that the sun is going to come up tomorrow, and if it's not going to, he already knows that too. God has planned ahead for all of those. So this is where a guy named Boaz enters the scene. To this point, not a lot hopeful has happened for Naomi and Ruth, but at least they have this opportunity to go out and gather some food in the field. And Boaz enters the scene, and this is all we know about Boaz, but it's really interesting. The only thing we know about Boaz is that he's the son of Rahab. It doesn't say that in the story. We only know that from the genealogies of Jesus that we find in the New Testament. If you remember Rahab several weeks ago, Rahab was a prostitute in Jericho. And when God's people came, they were going to take back the promised land. They were going to war against the city of Jericho. Rahab said, "No, not I. I believe that your God is God." And she actually came over to their side and aided the spies because she believed, based on what she had seen happening around them, that their God was God. And it's really interesting because here she is. She's a prostitute in a city that is a perpetual enemy of God's people. But when she says, "You know what, God, I want into your kingdom," he doesn't shut the door. He doesn't shut the door on anybody who wants into the household of God. He doesn't shut the door. It's pretty powerful stuff. And not only did he invite her in so that she could be saved from the calamity that befell Jericho, but God also gave her a significant role in the big story. What he's doing throughout human history, because she had a son named Boaz who's going to enter this scene right here. But when I look at Rahab, where she came from, and her attitude of humility and realizing that she wasn't worthy, it makes me think that when I start to feel like I'm pretty good, I'm pretty faithful, I'm reasonably well-disciplined in my actions, it reminds me that when I look through the story, God doesn't make a habit of using the people who think they're pretty good, pretty disciplined, and pretty well-behaved. He makes the habit of using the people and drawing in the people who realize they're not worthy. Just a little attitude check for me. That's all I'm saying. So Boaz is the son of a redeemed prostitute, and here he has this huge role in God's big story. Boaz tells Ruth when she comes to glean in the field, he says, "You know what, I've heard about what you did for Naomi. You take whatever you need." And he actually tells some of his workers, "You know what, just take some of what you've already harvested out so that Ruth can have it." And he ends up giving her more food than she actually needs. He treats her really well. Why? Because Boaz, he gets it. If you read through the story, one of the things you'll see in the details there is that he knows she's not just looking for food, but he knows that she's seeking refuge in the household of God. And Boaz is better at this than we are. Because what does he do? When he understands that she's not just looking for food, she's seeking refuge in the household of God's people, he does not waste any time taking his role as God's agent in that household. He doesn't do what I do and sit down and think, okay, well, I'll just wait here until God tells me exactly what to do. Well, usually I know what God wants me to do. Boaz takes action. He takes his role. That's a completely different conversation, but a good lesson for us to observe. So Ruth returns to Naomi with all this food that Boaz gave her. And Naomi's like, I know, you should marry Boaz. Right? He's rich. He's in the family. So let's do this. And, you know, that came on pretty quick. But Ruth's like, hey, I just met you. And this is crazy. There's never been a generational divide more obvious than it is in this room right now. Because half of the people just finished the song, and half of the people are waiting for me to finish saying what Naomi and Ruth were talking about. Ruth agrees. She's like, okay, I'll do it. Tell me what to do. So Naomi says just the oddest thing. Naomi describes this scene to her where during the harvest in their day, you know, they didn't go to work, go home, go to work, go home. They didn't commute like we do. They would just work until they couldn't work anymore, got dark or whatever. And then they'd camp out. You know, they'd have a meal and go to bed, and then get up at sunlight and work some more. So Naomi says to Ruth, listen, Boaz is going to be working. He's going to have a meal, and then he's going to lay down and go to sleep. Wait, I got to turn to the right page, though, before I can read that to you. All right. Tonight, this is Ruth telling Naomi, she says, tonight he will be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. Winnowing, I had to do some research because I'm clearly not an agrarian. That's when they like blow the air through it and separate the chaff from the wheat. Who knew? But probably a lot of you, just not me. Wash, put on perfume, and get dressed in your best clothes. Then go down to the threshing floor, but don't let him know you are there until he has finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, note the place where he is lying. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what to do. Now I know what you're thinking. I know what you're thinking. Things work a little differently in their society. You're thinking, this is about to get PG-13 real quick. That doesn't say something. That says something probably not great about our culture. But our culture and theirs collide really awkwardly at moments like this. This is not a hookup. That's not how it works. She basically is being forward. She's being very forward. But essentially, if you read through it and gather the context, what you'll see is she's basically asking Boaz to marry her. Take me into your family and care for you. Care for me. That's essentially what she's asking him. And he wakes up and sees her there, and he says, who are you? Now, if you're asking someone to marry you, and their immediate response is, who are you? That's got to take the wind out of your sails. Isn't that hard on the confidence? But she's resolved. I guess she probably didn't have a lot of other options. She puts herself out there, and she goes for it. And he says, who are you? I am your servant, Ruth. Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a guardian redeemer of our family. And this is where the story really gets down to business. The guardian redeemer is very, very significant and very symbolic to us who live in New Testament times. The whole story really is about the guardian redeemer. The entire Bible really is about the guardian redeemer. So if you've hung around here for a while, you may have heard us say things like, the Old Testament points toward Jesus, or the Old Testament conceals the New Testament. The New Testament is really hidden inside of the Old Testament, and the New Testament reveals what's happening in the Old Testament. Or you may have heard us say things like, the Israelites in the Old Testament are us. They're symbolic for us. You might have heard us say things like that. You may have heard us say things like, the Old Testament points toward Jesus. Those are all ways of essentially saying that when we read the Old Testament, we should be looking for how this points us toward Christ. We should be looking for ourselves in the story, because it really is just full of symbolism and foreshadowing. That's really what it's about. What do you suppose the guardian redeemer is? In their time, if a woman was widowed and she had no sons, she couldn't own property. She basically couldn't take care of herself. Well, even if she had sons, for that matter, she was dependent upon them to assume the property and take care of her. Now, that, of course, is a foreign concept to us in 21st century America, but it wasn't unique to Israel. That's been the case in most societies throughout human history. For better or worse, that's just how it was. So if a woman's husband dies, she was dependent upon other people. And if she had no sons to assume the land, it would pass on to one of many different places. There was a whole line of succession of people who might assume the land. But then she would just become dependent upon the good nature of whomever assumed the land. Now, when God gave them the promised land, he set up a system. It was pretty clever. Go figure. That's how God operates. By which the promised land would stay in the Israelite family for generation after generation. Because what could happen is, if I owned land and I died, someone that I owed money to could come and just take it. Didn't matter if they were an Israelite or not. You know, so the land could get fragmented up. But God set up this system by which someone in the family, a guardian redeemer, could come and buy the land from the widow. And when they did that, they would obviously keep it in the family, but they would also be assuming responsibility for the widow, for taking care of the widow. God put this system in place that the guardian redeemer, most translations say kinsman redeemer, which makes more sense, but the guardian redeemer could come in and buy back the widow, get the foreshadow here, buy back the widow, save her from a situation from which she had no power to save herself. She was helpless, but the guardian redeemer could come and buy her back. Give her a place to live, provide for her needs, allow her to stay in her home. The guardian redeemer could redeem the situation that was hopeless for her. So if you're looking for yourself in the story, I don't want to be the bearer of bad news, but you're not the guardian redeemer. You're the widow. Jesus is our guardian redeemer. That's the foreshadow. That's the imagery. Through his life, his death and resurrection, he has bought us back from sin, from death. Do you realize that in Christ, have you thought about the fact that death literally has no sting for you? It's irrelevant to you. He bought you back from sin, from death, from condemnation, and he saved us to his family, to his kingdom, to reconciliation with God, to eternal life. He's given us a role in the big story. Those are the things that the guardian redeemer does for us. So yeah, I'm pumped about Easter. It's a big deal. So here you have Boaz and Ruth at the end of the story. Ruth asks Boaz to be the guardian redeemer, and he's like, booyah. It's a weird translation in Hebrew, but he says yes. There's just one problem. He's not the first in the line of succession to become the guardian redeemer. There's somebody else who has a first right of refusal. And Boaz does something. He's really smart. He's clever about this. He goes and he waits at the city gate for the guy who's the first in the line of succession. We don't know who he is. We don't even know his name. When we get to heaven, we'll just say Roger, the guy who could have married Ruth. Let's call him Roger for the sake of our conversation. He goes and he waits for Roger. It's a good, strong Hebrew name. And he says, hey, here's the deal. You know, you're first in this line of succession, but let's get the town elders, the community elders together so that they can just, you know, be witnesses of our conversation. I'm reading this into the story, but what I think he's actually doing is he's getting the witnesses so that when he leads Roger to say what he wants him to say, he can just end the conversation and be like, okay, you heard it. I got my witnesses. That's kind of how it plays out. So he tells Roger, listen, here's the deal. You can buy this land from Naomi for pennies on the dollar or shekels on the denarii, whatever they had then. You can buy this land from Naomi. That's your option. You have the first right of refusal. And the guy's like, yeah, I'll do it. Awesome. That's a good deal. But then he says, we don't know all the dialogue, but when you do that, you'll also have to take responsibility for this other widow, Ruth. I'm guessing he didn't say, when you get a great deal on the land from Naomi, you'll also get Ruth. She's hot. I'd marry her for sure if I was in your position. It sounds like he kind of couches it. He frames it like it's going to be this other burden that you're going to have to take on, which is exactly what I would do if I was in his position. And so the guy like immediately backpedals. Oh, yeah, I can't do it. That might damage my own estate. I don't know how it would. Nonetheless, he says, I can't do it. Do it yourself. You get it. So here he is. Immediately, as soon as the guy says, you buy it yourself, this is what Boaz says. Then Boaz announced to the elders and all the people, "Today you are witnesses that I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Kilian, and Mahlon. I have also acquired Ruth the Moabite, Mahlon's widow, as my wife, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property, so that his name will not disappear from among his family or from his hometown. Today, you are my witnesses." He doesn't waste any time. Like, that was basically the wedding. Like, they're pretty much married now. And it's interesting, like, the language is so foreign to us because he says, "You're my witnesses that I did this so that the name, the family name, will stay here within the town." That kind of goes back to God's plan for keeping all the land in the family. But this is where the ground level story, just what's happening in the everyday lives of everyday people, Naomi, Ruth, Boaz, you, me, that ground lower story, it's where it really intersects with the high story. What's God doing in the course of human history? It's where we get a good snapshot of who God is and what he's up to, because we see this guardian redeemer come in and reconcile all that's gone wrong. He redeems, he recovers all that was lost, puts everything back into place as it should have been. Ruth, who was widowed at an apparent young age, now has not only a caretaker, but she has a husband in Boaz. And if you read the story, you can easily identify the fact that Boaz was probably a rock star husband. He wasn't just like some way for her to find food. He takes good care of her all along the way. And even Naomi, who got to the place of really being kind of self-destructive, even her who had resigned herself to bitterness, even she has new life because of this guardian redeemer. Even Naomi gets a second chance. Watch what it says about Naomi at the very end of the book. It says, "The women said to Naomi, 'Praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a guardian redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons, has given him birth.'" So she has a husband. She has someone to take care of her. She has Ruth, who, it says, loves her and takes care of her better than seven sons ever could have. And now she has a role in the big story. "Then Naomi took the child, the son of Ruth and Boaz, and cared for him. The women living there said, 'Naomi has a son,' and they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David," as in King David, as in David and Goliath. And if you chase the family tree down a little farther, who's there? Jesus. Naomi had an unbelievably significant role in the big story. Occasionally, I like to have fun and get a little mileage out of telling people that I'm related to Neil Armstrong or Lance Armstrong. I've even tried Louis Armstrong. Younger people that works on, older people are like, "No, I don't think you are related to him." But nothing trumps having Jesus in your family tree. Naomi had an unbelievably significant role. She went from saying, "My life is horrible. God has turned against me," to having this amazing role in the big story because of the guardian redeemer. And this is exactly the foreshadowing of Jesus in our lives. So before we go, we're going to take communion together. We're going to offer that for whoever wants to participate. And we'll sing one last song while we do that. But I want to encourage you, as you take communion, or if you choose not to, just as you're there at your seat, I want to encourage you to consider the fact that Jesus is your guardian redeemer. Naomi's situation really is emblematic of our situation. And Boaz is really emblematic of what Christ has done for us. He's come to redeem us from this situation, this problem of sin. We are not capable of redeeming ourselves from it. No matter how polished up we get, we're still not clean apart from Christ. He lived a sinless life, and as such, he became the perfect sacrifice when he died. And that's why we take the bread, because his body was broken to bear our punishment. And his blood became the perfect reparation for our sins. It's very simple. It's not a big deal. And he didn't stop there, though. He defeated death on our behalf so that we could simply look at the temporal nature of our lives and realize, you know what? Yes, this life is short, but my guardian redeemer has bought my life back. My life has no end because of the Guardian Redeemer, and that's who Christ is in our lives. Would you stand up with me?